This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. A beautiful Monday greetings to you. We've got a great show coming up today. Our third hour is America Committing Economic Suicide. Clyde Prestowitz is going to be with us, the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, Leslie Tolfe of the AFL-CIO. In our second hour, we're going to be asking the question, has the Bush administration been setting up a police state quite literally since the day they took office, and perhaps planning it from even before then? And in our first hour, our question, what straws are the global warming deniers grasping at this week, now that Al Gore has won the Nobel Peace Prize? Our quote for the day, in fact, from Al Gore, the scientists are virtually screaming from the rooftops now. The debate is over, says Al Gore. There is no longer any debate in the scientific community about this, but the political systems around the world have held this at arm's length because it's an inconvenient truth, because they don't want to accept that it's a moral imperative. Mark Morano, the communications director for the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, the GOP committee, now the minority head of that committee, James Inhofe, a member of his staff, would beg to differ. EPW.senate.gov, the website. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Pleased to have you here. Okay, Al Gore has won the Nobel Peace Prize. We have a headline in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this from the right-wing website, Drudge. Water may be limited. Georgia is considering unheard-of options for metro areas because of the drought down in Georgia. Front page of today's Wall Street Journal, an article about how they're growing grapes now that are competitive with American and French grapes in parts of Canada that never before could grow grapes. And the Wall Street Journal says this is a consequence of global warming. When's Senator Inhofe going to apologize to the rest of us?
Apologize? He is absolutely being vindicated as we speak in peer-reviewed journals. One of the oddest things of 2007 is that we have reached a tipping point, but it's the tipping point. If you look at the peer-reviewed journals, even committed scientists who believe in man-made global warming are now authoring studies, as Stephen Schwartz of the Brookhaven Labs, basically saying that a doubling of CO2 would have nowhere near the impact that the UN, or let alone Al Gore, is predicting. So Inhofe has absolutely nuts. First of all, Inhofe congratulated Senator Gore, former Vice President Gore, I should say, on his victory of the Nobel Prize. But keep in mind, this was a Nobel Peace Prize, not a Nobel Prize for science. And, again, this comes off. This is a political award. It's not, they didn't look at this based on science. They are not scientists who granted the award.
So the Nobel Peace Prize is essentially always a political award.
Well, it is very prestigious. Yeah. We have to just, look at it in the big scheme of things. This really doesn't change the scientific debate one ounce. And the scientific debate, if you actually look at it, 2007, the Antarctic ice has grown to a record level. The Southern Hemisphere is cooling. Greenland has cooled since the 1940s. Droughts, you mentioned drought in Georgia. Well, studies are showing droughts less frequent. I mean, it was the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, the Midwest in the 1930s, long before 80% of CO2 came after 1940. So we've had droughts. We've had this weather. The New York Times has admitted that we're well within natural variability. The whole entire debate still remains unproven computer models of the future.
So here we have the Northwest Passage.
The entire debate. The Northwest Passage was crossed in 19, I believe.
Mark, let me finish my sentence. Mark! Here's the
North.
Yeah, wait, I won't filibuster you if you won't filibuster me, okay?
Fair enough.
The Northwest, although, feel free to interrupt, but the Northwest Passage was something that, in the 1700s, in the 1600s, the 1500s, people were looking for. And now we have this explosion of a decrease in ice. The Pentagon has prepared a report now saying that global change over the next 20 years could result in a global catastrophe.
Again, that was an impact report, basically saying if this, then that. This is about unproven models. You talked about the Arctic. Actually, NASA just did a peer-reviewed study, October 3rd, and I can't remember if it was the Geophysical Letters, basically saying that the recent reduction of Arctic ice, and I'm talking about the last 2 years specifically, was not due to global warming. It was due to unusual winds that came in and broke up old ice and pushed it south and melted it.
And you think that the unusual winds are not a consequence of global warming?
According to this study, it was a wind pattern that blew this ice out into warmer waters. It was not due to any higher temperatures per se. Now, that's not to say the Arctic's not warming. The Arctic has a lot of factors involved. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which deals with ocean currents. Dr. William Gray, a hurricane specialist, has talked extensively on that and has actually criticized Gore specifically. And there's actually other peer-reviewed studies that have just come out this summer talking about a climate seesaw. Essentially, when the ocean currents can move the temperature back and forth depending on which hemisphere, and it's all part of a natural process. The question is, what has man contributed? What will man contribute? The Danish National Space Center, just in early October, this is not an ExxonMobil funded group, came out and said the sun remains the primary driver of global climate.
Well, it always has been. Come on, Mark. It always has been.
But they specifically
the sun is why we have plants.
All right, but they just
Mark. The bottom line here is that Senator Inhofe, for whom you work, and his buddies in the oil industry, you guys are still willing to bet the survival of our children and grandchildren on a premise that will continue to enhance the profits of the oil industry. And toss out this stuff that we really shouldn't do anything now. Let me just reframe this for just a second.
Sure.
You're suggesting, here's this debate, and I would call it a so-called debate, but you're suggesting it's a real debate about whether or not global warming is happening. There's no debate about whether carbon dioxide is exploding. There is absolutely no debate about the fact that we would not be. Well, maybe there is a debate about it, but in any case, probably not, about whether or not we would be in Iraq right now if their primary export was radishes, not oil.
Well, I'm not going to.
I know. Yeah, okay. You'll debate that with me, too. But the point is, 50% of our oil, we crossed the 50% threshold the first year that George Bush came into office of importing our oil. And in 1973, we were the world's largest oil exporter. We are now the world's largest oil importer. How about just as a national security issue? Suggesting
Absolutely.
To Senator Inhofe that it's time for us to stop using oil.
Let's set the science of global warming, man-made global warming aside, and let's talk. Senator Inhofe, absolutely, there's a lot of reasons to move off carbon-based energy, and not the least of which, as you mentioned, geopolitical conflicts, energy security, availability, and pollution, frankly, not related, not calling CO2 a pollutant, but other forms of pollution that come from that, from burning coal and that. So the issue is, how do you go about doing it? Do you empower international bureaucracy? Do you empower, as the Senator Lieberman wants to do, a presidentially appointed board that's going to put a price on carbon similar to the Federal Reserve? Is tying up the economy with more regulatory powers and weakening and affecting poor people, essentially. I mean, you're talking about families, $3,500 a family, $4,500 a family, depending on what cap and trade.
You think ultimately cutting their fuel bills is going to hurt them? Mark, are you suggesting that because the government, for example, offers a tax break for mortgages, for the interest that you pay on your home mortgage, which basically, and I think you'll acknowledge this, was a government intervention in the marketplace that tremendously benefited both banks and the middle-class homeowners,
sure,
that sort of thing should not be done to promote solar and wind energy?
Well, you're talking about two different things. Absolutely, we should do, and we are doing a lot, actually. I mean, obviously, you could argue not enough. But
that's not the free market. That is government intervention.
Right, but we're talking about a mandated cap-and-trade process, which is all it's going to do is make the big corporations with the best whale-heeled lobbyists to be able to come in and grease the skids of the system to get the best benefit. A lot of these corporations
join the call to change the system for public financing of elections, for example, to get the money out.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to get into public.
I mean, if you're saying that your solution won't work, that even the solutions that we agree on won't work because of all the money in Washington, let's fix that.
No, my point is technology is going to solve this problem regardless of government action in the end. I mean, you could talk all you want about subsidize this, tax breaks for that. The bottom line is even in China, each new coal plant is going to be cleaner than if China had had built the coal plants 10 years ago.
But Mark,
ago.
The free market never would have brought rural electricity to the United States. In fact, the electric companies were refusing to do it. Roosevelt had to shove it down the throats of the REA. They didn't want the telephone companies, didn't want to take telephone service to the rural parts of the United States. Those technologies, yeah, technology will grow, but is it going to grow in a way that actually really benefits the majority of people in America?
But the bottom line is you've already laid out the problems with carbon-based energy, and it deals with geopolitical, deals with issues of supply, deals with issues of pollution. So there's going to be a market for these new technologies, and they're coming on.
So let's create a market with a cap-and-trade system.
There's breakthroughs in new solar panel technology now. And, in fact, all the Hollywood celebrities, to say something complimentary, them buying all this, you know, all these alternative energy solar panels for their home, they're making it cheaper for the next generation. The problem is people are sold a bill of goods in the science. We're told we have a tipping point that all scientists agree. That's not true. The solution
is most scientists. Just most scientists.
Not
okay.
Even, absolutely not. The ones you see in the media, maybe, they're tied
yeah.
to the U.S.
Okay, most scientists on the IPCC. Mark Moran, I'll have that final word, but you can check it out at epw.senate.gov. Mark, thanks for coming on. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Razzle dazzle, you razzle dazzle them. You gave them an act with.
Global warming is an issue that my administration is very concerned about, deeply. Deeply in a deep kind of concerned way. I start my day and I think about the warming of the globe and how we can get it warmer.
Cut.
You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah! So, the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Northern Vintage, Canada's wines rise with mercury. And they're not talking about mercury contamination. They're talking about thermometers. Growers try classy grapes, shed punchline status. Mr. Kennedy sells his cows, the subtitle in Douglas Belkin's piece in today's Wall Street Journal. As global warming, he says, he talks about Canadian-style global warming. He says, as global warming encourages vintners to press ever further northward. That's from the third paragraph of the article. The fourth paragraph begins, the borders of the world's grape-growing regions are shifting away from the equator and toward the poles, redrawing the world wine map in the process. That must be those winds that Mark was talking about. Formerly frosty climates like this verdant corner of British Columbia are beginning to produce first-rate wines. They are, and then they go on to talk about how the finest wines in the world, such as Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon, are actually names of regions in France, and that these regions produce some of the world's best and most expensive wines. But, notes Belkin in today's Wall Street Journal front page story, but they're extremely sensitive to temperature. The thermal niche in which these types of grapes thrive is narrow, and the conditions required to produce a good vintage are narrower still. And then he talks about this is one of the reasons why this farmer in British Columbia, in Canada, is now starting to grow grapes. That's one reason why generations of Kennedys had raised mostly cows. And when his children informed him they didn't want to take over the dairy, he began looking for alternatives. His conclusion, winters were getting warmer, summers hotter, and the growing season longer. And so, gee, let's try grapes. And it's actually working. He's producing some damn good wines. Established winemaking regions are struggling to adapt to climate changes, notes the Wall Street Journal today. In Spain, winemakers are planting vineyards at higher elevations to escape excessive heat. In France, they are altering centuries-old irrigation traditions to accommodate longer, hotter summers. In Australia, researchers say that up to 11% of the grape-growing land will be too hot to use by 2030. 2030, what is that? 23 years from now. Not very long down the road. Meanwhile, all over the right wing, Al Gore made 9 mistakes in his movie. A British judge tells us so. Well, let's just put this in context. First of all, the judge is not a scientist. Secondly, he didn't. The case in point was the question about whether or not the disclaimer, essentially, that was given to school children, because they actually show this movie, An Inconvenient Truth, is shown in public schools or what are called state schools in the United Kingdom, what we would call public schools. It's shown in the state schools, the public schools in the United Kingdom, to everybody. And because it's about Al Gore, he's a politician, you know, in part. I mean, in part, it's a movie about him. It's not just about global warming. And it talks about his politics to some extent. And also because it's about an issue around which the oil industry in particular has generated considerable controversy. There is basically a disclaimer that is given to the kids that they have to sign that they read it that says, you know, this, there are opinions in this thing. And there may be even politics in this thing. And this is not presented to you as this is 100% the absolute accurate truth. This is presented to you as something to think about, to spur debate, actually, is the phrase that they use. And what this judge ruled was, oddly enough, that paper that they're signing right now is fine. Now, he went on and quoted a few areas where there might be some contention. Some of his debunking has been debunked, but, you know, the bottom line is, it's fine. But, boy, the right wing in this country, and for that matter in England, have just taken this thing and run with it like crazy. And they're even talking about an appeal of what the judge said, you know, about his 9 points. Yeah. In other news, well, and by the way, we'll be taking your calls on this and other issues right after the break. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And airamerica.com for our blog. But there are a number of other things happening in the world as we speak. And some of them, I think, you know, frankly, things that we really very much should be concerned about. One of them has to do with this fascinating story this weekend by Elizabeth Rosenthal in the New York Times. Comprehensive global study of abortion has concluded that abortion rates are similar in countries where it's legal and those where it's not, suggesting that outlawing the procedure does little to deter women from seeking it. On the other hand, where it is legal and contraceptives are widely available, such as Eastern Europe, abortion rates have fallen by 50%. The only difference seems to be that in those countries where it's illegal, you have about 4 times higher rate of women dying as a consequence of illegal abortions. And more of them. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise. We're living on the edge.
34 minutes past the hour. This, as we like to say from the wire services, just days after former Vice President Al Gore received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts on global warming, the United States Supreme Court handed Mr. Gore a stunning reversal, stripping him of his Nobel and awarding it to President George W. Bush instead. For Mr. Gore, who basked in the adulation of the Nobel Committee and the world, the High Court's decision to give his prize to President Bush was a cruel twist of fate, to say the least. But in a 5-4 decision, the justices made it clear that they had taken the unprecedented step of stripping Mr. Gore of his Nobel Prize because President Bush deserved it more. Chief Justice Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the majority, said, "It is true that Al Gore has done a lot of talking about global warming, but President Bush has actually helped create global warming." Even as Mr. Gore was being stripped of his Nobel, he received strong words of support from Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who said that the former vice president's Nobel win, quote, shows that he has devoted his life to the right thing and should definitely stay the course, end quote. In an interview with reporters in Iowa, Senator Clinton said, quote, Al Gore should remain dedicated to the cause of global climate change at least through November of 2008. Senator Clinton suggested that Mr. Gore could further research the source of global warming by immediately boarding a rocket ship to the sun. It's from Andy Borowitz, of course, with permission, BorowitzReport.com. Andy, one of the great humorists of our time. But it really highlights the point that Al Gore, the only president, Mark Morano referred to him as Vice President Gore, He's President Gore in my mind. He's the only president of the United States who never served as president of the United States. He was elected president by the majority of the voters, and he was elected president, should have been elected, and would have been elected president by the Electoral College had the Supreme Court not stopped the count in Florida. I mean, it's very straightforward. So, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your thoughts on this and anything else. Gene in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Gene.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was listening to what you said about the disclaimer on the Gore film.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like we should have also have a disclaimer on the evening news then, considering how the media is so biased. But what I did.
Well, what's so cool about this is that they're actually showing Al Gore's movie to every school child in England, and that the judge said that's just a fine thing. And the disclaimer is just a fine thing, and it's just, you know, go ahead with it. And now there's actually some questions about the family that brought the lawsuit and whether this was actually funded by the oil industry.
What I called about is the topic you and your guests were discussing, and what the climate change deniers never seem to acknowledge is the wild card in this situation, which is the recent deforestation of the Western Hemisphere, both the rainforests of South and Central America and North America. Where I live, there used to be massive redwood and oak forests, and that northern rainforest is gone now, too. And forests are like the living air cleaning filter. And
They're the lungs of our world.
Yeah, like the cilia in the lungs have been damaged. And even if the deniers claim human pollution is no different from volcano pollution, they can't say there's no difference in the planet's respiratory system right now.
Yeah.
So I think that's where their argument completely falls. They just can't even they can't deny it.
Yep. Good point, Gene. Thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry. Sometimes you know these buttons have about a quarter second delay in them. My apologies, Gene. And also, you know, somebody called in last Friday when right after Bernie, the hour after Bernie, and said I was going to ask Bernie a question, and I said, Bernie's gone, and I cut him off. And Mercury went retrograde the day before. I don't know. What can I say? I apologize for being grouchy. Adam in Seattle. Hey, Adam. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. I watched a pretty unnerving program on August 18th from NOVA, and I think the title was Dimming the Sun, where they spoke of the particulate matter that human emissions are sending into the atmosphere.
Yeah, this is
a thick layer that
mm-hmm.
is reducing sunlight to the Earth up to 20%
right.
in some regions and up to 30% in, I think they said, Russia, which is causing those
wide
wind changes that your guest earlier was talking about, and possibly Europe and America are responsible for the Ethiopian deaths due to the changing of the Sahara winds.
Yeah,
and around the equatorial belt.
And Darfur as well. I mean, they've experienced massive climate change in that part of the world over the last 20 years. And this is the terrible conundrum, Adam, and you're pointing it out, is that there are a lot of scientists who are suggesting, in fact, I think it's probably a broad consensus, that if we could snap our fingers and eliminate all air pollution tomorrow, in other words, get all the particulate matter out of the atmosphere, that it would decrease the reflection of sunlight back or in heat back out into the atmosphere so much that so much more sunlight would be striking the Earth that we would slam into global warming, whereas right now we're kind of lazily moving into it because along with all that carbon dioxide is a whole lot of crud that is reflecting the sunlight and the heat back out into space. And so as we move toward cleaner technologies...
Yeah, we're going towards cleaner cars, cleaner scrubbers in the coal plants, as your guest was saying, in China. The China is definitely going to get cleaner. And as we do, they're going to notice a big change in the world towards 2050, is I think what they said.
Yeah, good point. Adam, thank you very much for the call. Robert in Tennessee. Hey, Robert.
Hello, Tom. Say, I was very disturbed. I heard last Thursday or Friday you said, you thought we needed a reconciliation commission and that we ought to forgive Bush and his cronies, and I just can't understand that. Michael Vicks kills a dog, loses his job, his income, faces 15 years in prison. George Bush kills 100,000 Iraqis, 4,000 Americans, wounds 40,000, and you want to forgive him? Where is that?
Well, let me put it in context for you, Robert. In South Africa, you had a regime a government which included thousands of people, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people who over a period of years systematically engaged in horrific crimes, war, what if it had been done outside of South Africa would be called war crimes, crimes against their own people. And in order to try to bring the country together, in order to try to heal the country, they called, and this, Nelson Mandela played a large role in this, they called a commission of reconciliation where they basically said, if you were involved in these crimes and you come forward and confess your guilt, then we will not pursue penalties against you. You will be labeled as a criminal, but we will not pursue penalties against you. We'll give you another chance. And what I was suggesting was not specific just to George W. Bush. We have you have corporations in America who have participated in illegally wiretapping us. You have arguably thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. military who have participated in what, if you're using the Nuremberg tribunals as a basis, may well be war crimes. You have private contractors who have engaged in war crimes. You have members of Congress who have been complicit in this. Right across the board, you have the increasing militarization of police departments across this country, where they're spying on people, they're arresting people, the suppression of civil liberties and all these kinds of things. And frankly, I think that, you know, prosecuting George Bush isn't enough. I think that we need a wide national systemic, oh my God, we really screwed up, and how are we going to fix it? And I don't think that the way that we will fix it is by simply prosecuting a few people. I think, you know, after World War II, after the Nazis, and this is not to compare the Bush administration to the Nazis, but there's a lesson here. After World War II, most of the people who participated, who were members of the Nazi Party, who participated in that horrific violence and the genocide and the Holocaust, were allowed to go back to their lives and were forgiven is the wrong word, but it was similar to what happened in South Africa. And I think that if we were to call for a commission for reconciliation and ask people to come forward, and those people who don't come forward and confess, by the way, they do get prosecuted, as they did in South Africa, and they do get long jail sentences. And my guess is Bush would never confess and he would end up in jail. But I'm talking about something really big and really national here. Now, in that context, what do you think?
I understand the South African racial divide and the one-sidedness of the persecutions, and think it was a good thing. And I think perhaps the secondary criminals that you mentioned, accomplices, may be what you're suggesting may be good. But I remember after the Vietnam War, the fact that the United States never owned up to what went on, I believe, has led us to where we are repeating that same debacle again today. The things that the government accused the peace movement of were the things that the government was doing, but right. The American public was never told of those things.
Right, and it wasn't told because we didn't have the national stomach for and weren't willing to participate in prosecution of all the little Lieutenant Callies out there. And there were many of them. I mean, there were god-awful and horrific crimes committed in Vietnam, not to mention those committed at the level of Henry Kissinger. I mean, watch the video, the crimes of Henry Kissinger, and Richard Nixon of deciding to drop napalm on people and deciding to bomb Hanoi over Christmas and things like that, you know, leading to massive civilian casualties. But we just didn't have the stomach for, or we chose not to prosecute those people who participated. Had we had a reconciliation commission after the Vietnam War, I think it would have prevented where we are right now. So I'd just like you to think about it. I'm not absolutely certain it's the best thing for us, Robert, but I think it's a good start. At least I think it's something that should be debated. Robert, thank you. Thank you for your thoughts. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I've got to run. Appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270. Neil in Long Island, New York. You're on the air, Neil.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
So I have, just a point to make regarding Al Gore, and it has nothing to do with the science or whether you agree with him or not. But you would think if you were an advisor to Bush or an advisor, quite frankly, to any of the Republican presidential candidates, that you would say to them, hey, listen, go out there, give the guy his kudos, give him credit, tell the world that we're proud that an American, although we may not always agree with him, that we're proud that an American has received this high honor. But it's amazing how, you know, it's one of the things that Bill Clinton was very good at. He was always able to acknowledge his adversaries. He's always able to compliment.
Bill Clinton made a Republican his Secretary of Defense, William Cohen.
That's right.
I mean, he was absolutely willing and capable to reach across the divide, and you're absolutely right, Neil.
I'll never forget when Bill Clinton, I think it was for, they unveiled the portrait of Bush's father. I'm not sure when it was, but Bill Clinton got up there, and the first thing he said, gee, I must be the only guy in America that likes George Bush. And the way he said it, the way it came across, you kind of said, you know what, this guy's real. So you figure that one of these presidential candidates on the Republican side, or Bush himself, that somebody would have said to them, hey, get out there in front of the cameras, tip your hat to the guy, look credible. Because you know what, if you can't, even if you don't believe it, even if you don't acknowledge your adversary's good things once in a while, then you really start to look like, I hate to say it, a horse's ass. That's all I'm
exactly.
Say.
How? Yeah. Well said, Neil. Thanks a lot. How can you be a statesman and a diplomat if you can't even acknowledge, hey, an American won the Nobel Prize, and good on him. I may disagree with his points of view, but good on him for that. Yeah. Good point. Steve in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Nice to speak to you. I appreciate your program more than I can say. Wanted to react, first of all, to Neil's last statements, which I think were great, and I think it indicates that this is somewhat the condition that we would find ourselves in terms of national reconciliation, like you were speaking earlier. No, we didn't acknowledge Vietnam like we could have, should have, and didn't. And maybe that is where we are today. I know that we are where we are, and in terms of national reconciliation, for example, I think it's far away, unfortunately, still in my prayers, that Nancy Pelosi, for example, wouldn't put impeachment on the table. It's
right.
Not politically expedient, and this political expediency thing is driving politics. We don't want to ask the question on the debates. What about the role in the Constitution for impeachment? What about a debate?
Or for making war, for that matter. You know,
yeah.
That only Congress will have the power to declare war. I think the larger issue here, Steve, and I think you're right, that, you know, I feel that Nancy Pelosi owes all of us an apology for that. That's just my personal feeling. But beyond that, the issue of reconciliation, the reason why a National Reconciliation Commission worked so well in South Africa, and the reason why I think it resonates with people, and the reason why after World War II, Germans who had been in the German army were allowed to go back to their homes and their communities and go to work, and the reason why people are afraid of it, frankly, at a certain level, and here's the big one, the reason why people are afraid of it, is because most of us are unwilling to acknowledge the essential banality, the essential normalness is the wrong word, but of evil. The fact that fundamentally good people can do horrible things. We all operate on this fantasy, and it's frankly a fantasy, that only truly horrible people are capable of doing horrible things. And therefore, all the average soldiers in Germany who were loading the boxcars, they were truly horrible, evil people. And yes, they did truly horrible, evil things. But if you look at examples all across the world, you find that average normal people who, if they just had a decent economy and a decent country to live in and a decent job to go to, would live their entire lives with decency. average people are capable of ungodly horrific things. And very few people want to acknowledge that reality. And what a reconciliation commission does is it acknowledges that reality. And that's something that requires extraordinary emotional maturity, both on the part of the individuals involved and of the nation. And it's a healing, it's, as it was for South Africa, a powerful and healing thing and a maturing thing. And frankly, I think that this country is so emotionally and politically immature, that's one of the reasons why we wouldn't go there.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's one of the reasons, primary reason that you're so good at your craft is that you're an educator. You're a teacher that knows something about, a lot, actually, about history on this country, and many others know little or nothing. They don't know their grassroots. They don't know the Constitution. They don't know the evolution of much of anything. And truly, they're in denial about their own lack of righteousness, and they would rather see somebody else wicked and evil. And
right. We all want to believe in, oh, it's just the evil sociopath out there. Thank you, Steve. It's, you know, well said. And this is why George Washington, when he took British soldiers who, by the way, had in many cases taken American soldiers captive and then murdered them, slaughtered them. When he took British soldiers prisoner, he treated them well. And the consequence of that, and after the war, offered them an amnesty. And the consequence of that was twofold. Number one, British soldiers in huge numbers surrendered, which helped us win the war. And number two, many of our best citizens after the Revolutionary War were people who had come over here as British soldiers and decided to stay. Said, hey, this is a wise, mature nation of thoughtful people who really understand, you know, the nature of humanity. Our question next... The police state?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Welcome back. A year and a half ago, I wrote an op-ed piece that was first published over at commondreams.org titled Reclaiming the Issues. It was about framing the issue of the illegal, illegal, whatever you want to call it, spying that the Bush administration claimed they have been doing since 9/11 on American citizens. And my headline was Reclaiming the Issues, Why is Bush Spying on Democrats? And the point I made, and I think it's and the reason why I'm giving you this kind of I told you so, I guess, or this little bit of history, as it were. The point that I made back a year and a half ago, and I really wish the Democratic Party had taken it and run with it, is that this is the question before us now. Did George Bush, as soon as he came into office, begin the process of establishing a police state in the United States? And not just George Bush. George Bush, Dick Cheney, John Ashcroft, people within the Justice Department, people within the Michael Hayden, within the National Security Agency, people within the CIA, people in local police departments all across the country. Did we begin setting up a police state, or maybe was this an attempt to do what Richard Nixon had done and what had been done out of Orrin Hatch's office? Keep in mind, Nixon said he was spying on Americans to keep us safe from communists, right? We were in the middle of a war, after all, a Cold War, but We thought of it as, I mean, you know, you got 9,000 nukes pointed at you. Makes you a little nervous. Soviets were out to get us. They had real weapons of mass destruction. Not phony ones. Not maybe ones. Not ones that might become active within 10 years. And the North Vietnamese weren't far behind, according to Nixon. You will recall one of Nixon's arguments was, if we don't stop them there, we're going to stop them in California when they hit the Pacific coast. Nixon told Americans that he had to spy on us to protect our liberties. Problem was, he turned that tool of domestic surveillance against his political enemies and people like Daniel Shore, the journalist, who were not necessarily political enemies, but nonetheless he saw them as enemies. Nixon was spying on Democrats and trying to cover it up with a fig leaf of, quote, national security, end quote. He set aside all the highbrow talk about separation of powers and intent of the founders. And this is what the FISA and other similar laws boil down to, stopping, this is why we passed them in the wake of Nixon, stopping the president from spying on his political opponents. FISA was passed to prevent political abuse, to prevent the possibility of political abuse of the right of the executive branch to engage in the investigative process through things like the FBI. It does have police powers. To prevent that one branch, you know, we have the legislative branch, the executive branch, the judiciary, the judicial branch. The judicial branch does not have police powers. The legislative branch does not have police powers. The executive branch is the branch to which police powers are given, not by the Constitution, but by law created by the executive or by the legislative branch. So the legislative branch creates a law that says, okay, you can, this is a crime. It's a crime to, you know, fill in the blank, right? It's a federal crime to kill people with a particular type of gun in particular place. It's a crime one of the more recent examples, in my lifetime, it became a federal crime to conspire to kill the president of the United States. I believe that happened more, you know, actually it probably goes back some time. But the fact of the matter is that when Kennedy was assassinated, the legal crime that happened, I'm pretty sure this was after 63, because the legal crime was actually murder in the state of Texas. And the Texas authorities were absolutely flipped out that they took his body to Bethesda, Maryland, because they said, we've got jurisdiction here. Murder is not a federal crime. So anyhow, the Congress passes a law making something a crime, and then they give to the executive branch the power to make sure that the crime isn't happening, or if it is, to prosecute it through the FBI, through the federal court system, through federal prisons. And then the judiciary oversees the entire thing. So the FISA law was set up after Nixon was using the right, or the power, rather, of spying, after he was using that to spy on his political opponents, on Democrats. The legislature got together and said, you know, the next time the president or anybody in the executive branch wants to spy on an American, they have to go to the third branch, the judicial branch, and justify this based on probable cause, the threshold mentioned in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, that a reasonable person would believe that probably a crime is being committed here based on actual evidence. You have to have enough evidence to establish probable cause before you can even get the warrant. And so they set up the FISA courts. And now we are discovering, this all goes back to Joseph Nakio. This is the guy, Joseph Nakio was the CEO of Quest, one of the big telco companies. And I believe he's sitting in jail right now. He might be out on bail, but I don't think so. I think he's in jail. He was convicted of insider trading, 19 counts of insider trading. And the basis of his conviction was that in 2001, he sold a whole bunch of stock right after his auditors came to the executives, which included him, and said, next month we're going to have a bad earnings report, which tends to drive down the price of stock. And before that information was made public. In other words, before the stock price dropped. So he sold a whole bunch of stock, and then right after that, the stock price dropped. And that's illegal. Another law made by the legislative branch that's enforced by the executive branch through the Securities and Exchange Commission and the FBI and federal courts. And so they nailed him for this. They said, you know, this is a crime what you did. And he was convicted of 19 counts of insider trading. So now he comes back and he says, Here's why it wasn't insider trading. I was simply selling stock, which I'm entitled to sell because it was part of my compensation. A lot of CEOs now, in addition to their salary, because the federal cap on the tax deductibility of a CEO's salary is $1 million. This was an attempt to, at the legislative level, after the Reagan tax cuts, after we did away with the 71% tax rate on top income tax rates, and Reagan crashed it down to around 30%, CEO salaries just started going through the roof. And so Congress said, okay, we've got to stop this. So they said a company can only deduct up to $1 million in CEO pay. So what companies did was they said, okay, that's cool. We'll only pay our CEO $1 million, but we'll give him $20 million for the stock options. And if he stays with us for a year and a half, then he suddenly owns the stock, and he can sell that stock and put the money in the bank. And because selling the stock is a capital gain, it's only taxed at the 15% tax capital gain rate, the rich person's tax of 15% maximum income tax, rather than the working person's 30-some-odd percent tax rate. So Nakio comes forward and he says, I was not doing insider trading because at the same time that I learned that we were going to have a bad earnings report, we were also negotiating with the NSA to start spying on Americans. And we were pretty sure we were going to get this huge contract from the NSA that was going to make us as much money or more money than we were going to lose. So our stock price was not going to fall because we were going to, be able to announce this contract, and we were going to have a good month or a good quarter. And this was 6 months before 9/11. We now know that AT&T, or it certainly appears, according to testimony in other court cases and in this, that AT&T was building a surveillance center, a wiretapping center, at one of their primary offices long before 9/11. Essentially within 2 months of the time that Bush and Cheney came into office. So the question, has the Bush administration been setting up a police state since the day they took office? And or was this intended to spy on Democrats, to establish a single-party rule? Keep in mind, Karl Rove's idea was 100 years of Republican rule, much like Adolf Hitler's idea was 1,000 years of single-party rule. 100 years of peace, 1,000 years of peace. I mean, it was all the same idea in some regards. And if so, what do we do about it? 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
See, even today, the New York Times is editorializing about this. You know this is huge, and they are condemning the Democrats for not standing up to this. Here we're talking about, at the very least, the administration having the power to spy on its political enemies, and at the most, turning the United States into a police state. This is absolutely and fundamentally un-American. It is unconstitutional. It is illegal. It has been done with lies and secrecy. The Bush administration, President Bush, for example, on May 11th, 2006, a year and a few months ago, he said, and I quote, after September 11th, now remember that, after September 11th, I vowed to the American people that our government would do everything within the law to protect them against another terrorist attack. As part of this effort, I authorized the National Security Agency to intercept the international communications of people with known links to Al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations. Now, it all started, that paragraph begins with after September 11th. It turns out it wasn't after September 11th. He was lying to us again. Ken Mellman, former Republican Party chair, and good friend of Jeff Gannon. Ken Mellman, this is authority the president does have. It's authority that is consistent with protecting our Constitution and our civil liberties, and it's an authority that is critical to learning the lessons of 9/11. We know that in April of 2001, six months before 9/11, Dick Cheney had been given, had been put in charge of two task forces within the White House, the Counterterrorism Task Force and the Energy Task Force. The Counterterrorism Task Force never met until September of 2001. But the Oil Task Force, you look at the documents, you can see them over at judicialwatch.org. Just go over there and plug into their search engine, Iraq Oil, and you can read them. As of March 2001, this is the meetings that Cheney was having with the oil company executives that he would not allow anybody from an environmental organization into. And here's the list. Where is the oil in Iraq? There's a map of Iraq with all the supergiant oil fields, other oil fields, earmarked for production sharing, oil pipeline, operational refineries, and tanker terminals. These are the things that are marked on the map. So you kind of get the idea that this is a map about oil, because those are the only things on the legend. And they name the fields, the Touba field, for example. They were thinking that Sonatrach, a company based out of Algeria, would be interested in buying Block 6 and 7 of the Touba field. The Halafia oil field. Block 6 of that. Perhaps the Australian company BHP would be interested in buying the oil from there or drilling there. The Adab oil field, Block 2, in Iraq. They thought that perhaps the Belgian company Petrofina would be interested in buying that oil field, in drilling there. And you go through here, and there's a long list of which oil companies would want to buy the oil in which one of these oil fields. This was March 5th, 2001, long before 9/11, Dick Cheney sitting around inside the White House with a bunch of oil industry executives carving up the oil fields of Iraq. So we know they were planning that. We know now that they were spying on us before 9/11. Why are the Democrats not saying, A, Bush, we want to know if you were spying on us for political purposes? Because, in fact, we know that the Republicans were doing that. Remember November of 2003? Republicans in the Senate, including a staffer for Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, hacked into the computers of Ted Kennedy and Dick Durbin. Reading Kennedy and Durbin's correspondence, Republican operatives discovered the strategy the Democrats intended to use to attack Republican high court nominees. They leaked 15 bits of Kennedy's discussions to the Wall Street Journal and other Republican-friendly sources, who used the information to successfully trash and thwart the Democratic plans. As this story rolled out on February 10, 2004, the New York Times ran a headline, "Democrats suggest inquiry points to wider spying by GOP." But it stopped there, because Bill Frist in the Senate would not allow an investigation of it. Because at the Justice Department, throughout the Justice Department, at the CIA, at the FBI, there would be no investigation of it. Because the Bush administration, because over in the House of Representatives, there would be no investigation. Right across the board, the Republicans controlled all of these agencies, and right across the board they said, even though the Democrats have proof that the Republicans have been spying on Democrats for purely political purposes. This is in 2004. It will not be investigated. To the best of my knowledge, it still has not been investigated. And now Congress is talking about giving Bush expanded spy power, because this bill that they passed in fear before they went into their August recess, because they were, all these rumors were passing around about Bin Laden's going to hit Washington, D.C. any day now, you better get out of town. And by the way, pass our law. This expires in February. I think they ought to just let it expire and just say, sorry, Mr. Bush, we are not sending you anything, veto or not. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Don't you sit in silence.
So here we have Joseph Nakio, the CEO of Quest, who, by the way, was apparently the only CEO of any of the telecommunications companies who refused to go along with letting the NSA set up little black boxes in their offices and listen in on people's telephone conversations. And, by the way, is the only CEO of any of the telecommunications companies who is sitting in jail right now, saying that He wasn't doing insider trading. They were negotiating with the NSA back in January, February of 2001, March of 2001, to spy on Americans and make a lot of money on it. But he looked at this. He had his lawyers look at this, and they decided it was illegal. And they said to the Justice Department, or they said to the NSA, rather, no, we're not going to do it. This is illegal. And now he finds his butt in jail. There is all this evidence accumulating that the Bushies have been that the Republicans have been spying on us since the beginning of 2001, long before 9/11, which A, suggests that it didn't have anything to do with stopping 9/11. Right? If Bush is going to run around and say, I need to spy on you without telling you about it because that'll stop 9/11. Well, I'm sorry, it didn't stop 9/11. Or B, did it help them to know that 9/11 was coming so that they could exploit it politically, so that, C, they could then follow? Now, this is where I realize we're getting into conspiracy theory territory here, but so that Dick Cheney's energy task force that was meeting on March 5th, and go over to judicialwatch.org and just plug in Iraq oil into their search engine, you can see the actual documents they got as a result of their lawsuit. So that when Dick Cheney was and his oil industry buddies were planning on carving up Iraq, they needed an excuse to invade Iraq, as the committee for present danger and as the Project for New American Century said over at their website back in 1998, we need a Pearl Harbor event. Did all of this wiretapping allow the Bushies to know that there was one coming? Is this why Colleen Rowley was so marginalized? I mean, you could take this as far as you want to go with it. The reality is that I think that any of these scenarios are conceivable because none of them have been seriously investigated. We don't know. What we do know is that we have been consistently lied to, and there has been an unconstitutional and, frankly, I think illegal and impeachable power grab by this White House and by the Republicans in the House and Senate who have abetted it, and a number of Democrats who are willing to go along with it as well. And at least one independent, that would be Mr. Lieberman. And I think, frankly, all of them should be facing the people, whether it's through an impeachment process or, you know, obviously being held accountable in the courts or in the ballot box. Excuse me. Speaking of the ballot box, Bill in Mansfield, Massachusetts, you have some thoughts on this.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
You're on the air. I am very saddened and worried about this entire business, so much so that I don't really think that spying on us is the central concern. I think the central concern is that we have free elections, that we have compelling evidence, that we each and every one of us believe that we're going to have honest elections. Otherwise, we'll wind up with something like, here's one scenario, winning the presidency. There'll be a liberal or progressive in the presidency, and there'll be, son of a gun, a bunch of Republicans in Congress with control of Congress. The man in the White House won't stand a chance. Neither will the American population.
You know, when the redshift began, Bill, the exit polls disagreeing with the voter outcomes, it began in the primary that George Herbert Walker Bush ran in New Hampshire, the first year that they were using voting machines there.
Yep. And
that's when it began.
There's no reason to believe it's been fixed. There's no reason to believe they won't do it again.
No, in fact, to the contrary, the government of Ireland spent 50 million euros, $60 million on voting machines and voting software and allocated 6 million euros or 5 million euros, $6 million, for a national publicity campaign about how wonderful they were. They already spent the $60 million, already bought the voting machines, and last week announced that they are disposing of them.
Good
They're going to destroy them. They're not going to use them.
You say good on them.
Yeah, because they looked into these things and they said these companies will not give us the source code. We cannot confirm that they are safe and accurate. Therefore, we are not going to go with it. Ireland has said no to electronic voting, and
good
we need to do
them.
The same. Yeah,
their democracy means so much to them. I wish. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, no. Well, you said it very well, and I appreciate your saying it. And the fact of the matter is that about 80% of Americans are going to be voting on machines or voting on systems that are owned by private corporations, or at least the software is. And you know, privatizing our vote. I mean, they're privatizing the army with Blackwater. They're privatizing. And by the way, that's a whole other problem. What happens in Iraq if we decide to pull out, and all the private corporations say, "Hey, we've got no reason to stick around here. We're not going to make any more money beyond the next couple of months. We're out of here. We're not going to take any more risk." And those private corporations then leave in the lurch 180,000 U.S. troops who no longer have somebody to deliver their mail and provide them with their food or provide logistical support. Another reason why we never should have privatized all that stuff in the first place. But anyhow, I digress. Weldon in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Weldon, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make you aware of PBS's Frontline show that's going to be airing tomorrow about Cheney's decades-long attempt at taking over, the executive power from the Congress.
Thanks for the heads up. I saw a quote over the weekend on, I think it was over on the Daily Kos, where he was talking about how these guys don't know how to run government, and he was referring to the Clinton administration. They're out of control or something like that.
Basically, yeah, he wants to give the president unlimited presidential power for wartime powers anyway for the rest of.
Right, and the only way to do that is to have a war, and that's why 9/11 was such a gift to them, which then raises the question, if they were doing all this illegal wiretapping, and it was legitimate, you know, let's look at the bad guys wiretapping. They were wiretapping the Saudis. They were wiretapping Osama bin Laden and friends back in early 2001. We know of over 50 specific warnings that were given to Bush, including the famous August 5th memo, bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. Why didn't they do anything about it? I mean, you know, is this a conspiracy of non-action? Oh, let's just let that happen. It'll be very useful for us to have Marius van der Lubbe light the Reichstaggebüge on fire. It certainly was helpful in another time in another place. Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Leonard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mr. Hartman, and I want to thank you because, if I called over to our right-wing friends and tried to disagree with you like some of your other callers, there's no way I would have been given a chance like the other callers you've been giving today and in all your shows to give you a logical, reasonable response when they disagree. So, Mr. Hartman, thank you, and thank Air America and all the progressive radio networks out there. But I'm kind of changing the subject now. I'm just, basically, critics will say you have stated circumstantial evidence, but the evidence is hard fact, Mr. Hartman. And unfortunately, this is pointing to me that my beloved Democratic Party is becoming the Maginot Line was to Adolf Hitler, is now becoming to George Bush. They need to do something.
We've got a bunch of Neville Chamberlains in here.
We do, Mr. Hartman, and the thing we need to remember is I will be a Democrat, I will be a lifelong Democrat, but I will not be a blind follower, and we will retake our party, and it's thanks to people like you who say we will have open debate and we will have many candidates in our primaries to bring out these issues that we will retake the party and we will get to the bottom of this and stop this military-industrial complex, this war service industry now, which makes money off of disasters. Mr. Hartman, thank you. I'm down here in Phoenix. We listened to you, and when you came down to Phoenix, it was a great honor to meet you. And thanks to all of your callers who bring all of the information that they do. You have a good day.
You're welcome. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you very much for your call. And your point is well taken. Michael in Los Angeles, not about me, but, you know, about the topics. Michael in Los Angeles.
Hey, Tom. All the stuff about what Bush has done and the fact that he actually was indicted for spying on Americans, which could be considered...
And found guilty by a federal judge in Detroit. Let's not forget Anna Dix Taylor was her name, as I recall.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, what he has done is illegal and unconstitutional, and that's being appealed right now by the Bush administration.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that it could be considered, it could be looked at as this is an attempt to undermine the U.S. government and therefore treasonable. However,
yeah, it's not just an attempt; it's an actual. I mean, I think that what we've been watching, frankly, is a silent coup.
Yeah, That's exactly what I believe, too, and I believe the attempt to break the military, which could be construed as giving an edge to private contractors, the same edge that the brown shirts had to the German army.
Right. Most Americans, let me just interrupt you for a second here. Most Americans don't realize what you're talking about. The brown shirts were the shock troops that Hitler used in the early days as he was consolidating power, and they were not government employees. They were not the army. The brown shirts were basically a private club. You know, Hitler's partisan buddies. It was as if the Republican Party contracted with Blackwater to create a private independent army within the country. That's what the brown shirts were.
Yeah, and in addition, the German army was choked by the Versailles Treaty. But the reason that I'm calling is a lot of people are. Oh, can you hold me over for the break? If that's
sure, I can.
Yeah, thanks.
Hang on just a second, Michael. Thanks a lot. 10:45 minutes. We do have to take these breaks, and in fact, this is the way you can support the program is by supporting our sponsors. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman program. Has the Bush administration been setting up a police state since the day they took office? Is a silent coup underway? How do we stop it?
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low. As if to hear, well, in the armies, they ceased advancing because the people held their ear. Oh, and the shepherds and the soldiers, well, they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions and laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, oh, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awakened into the cry. People have the power.
People, yeah, it's the people power. Have the power in the United States, or at least that's the theory, and we need to take people that power back. Michael in Los Angeles, you want to make one quick point because I got Victoria Jones on the line from the Talk Radio News Service here. I got to get to Michael.
Do is the Democrats are always talking about treason and treasonable acts, but I need some help. Democrats are not good at organizing, and I'd love to have some help in identifying those possible treasonable acts. We need to lay them out. I'd love to know what they are, and your help would be brilliant. I know it would.
Okay, so what are the? Thank you, Michael. I would suggest that you go back and listen to our conversation with Bruce Fein and others about, you know, what's impeachable. Because frankly, I think that's, you know, not all that different. And there is a fairly straightforward list: lying us into a war, caging over 1 million votes, stealing 2 elections, or arguably 3 or 4 elections, summary execution and willful killings, assassinations, foreign assassinations, violations of the Presidential Records Act through the RNC emails, warrantless wiretaps, which we've been talking about, extraordinary renditions and torture, and there's a new movie coming out called Rendition, violating habeas corpus, a principle that's been in place since the year 1215, torture at home, torture overseas. These against the war crimes laws in the United States and international laws, the violations of the Hatch Act by Sarah Taylor, Karl Rove, and others. I mean, there's no shortage of crimes that this administration has committed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, people are talking about a couple of things. Some are talking about the puff piece on Blackwater in yesterday's 60 Minutes. Others are talking about General Sanchez. People are just blown away by what he had to say, even though people have a pretty poor opinion of him because of Abu Ghraib. They're still pretty stunned by what he had to say about the war being a nightmare with no end in sight. And even stronger language, really, from a catastrophically flawed, unrealistically optimistic war plan to the administration's latest surge strategy. This administration has failed to employ and synchronize the political, economic, and military power. Quite extraordinary language,
right.
Really.
And in fact, if I may just drop 30 seconds of General Sanchez in here, may I, Victoria?
Oh, please do. He's better than
Here's,
me.
Here are his comments.
While the politicians espouse a rhetoric designed to preserve their reputations and their political power, our soldiers die. Our national leadership ignored the lessons of World War II as we entered into this war. and to this day continue to believe that victory can be achieved through the application of military power alone. Our commanders on the ground will continue to make progress and provide time for the development of a grand strategy. That will be wasted effort, as we have seen repeatedly since 2003. In the meantime, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines will continue to die. It will take the Army at least a decade to fix the damage that has been done to its full-spectrum readiness. Who will demand accountability for the failure of our national political leadership involved in the management of this war? They have unquestionably been derelict in the performance of their duty. In my profession, these types of leaders would immediately be relieved or court-martialed.
In his profession, these kind of leaders would be court-martialed. It sounds to me like he's calling for the impeachment of George Bush.
He's coming pretty darn close to it. Pretty darn close. He does say...
Yes. Unless you're going to talk about the French Revolution and the guillotine, I don't know what else he could be talking about.
Well, he's getting extremely close to it. Yeah. But he says one thing that I found very disturbing. When he was asked why he didn't speak out about his concerns, and he says that you take an oath to carry out the orders of the president, which is fair enough. But then he says the last thing that America wants, the last thing that you want, is for currently serving general officers to stand up against our political leadership, which kind of sounds as though you're going to carry out orders without asking any questions at all, which I would contend is perhaps not what Americans want.
Well, actually, let me defend him on that, because the big argument at the founding of this country was whether or not there should be a standing army during times of peace. And the Federalists thought there should be, modern-day Republicans, and Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans, which is today's Democratic Party, felt there should not be, and tried to write it into the Constitution. The Second Amendment is a fragment of that original amendment, which said there shall be no standing army during time of peace, but instead there shall be local militias, and those, in order to maintain well-ordered local militias, the right of citizens to bear weapons shall not be abridged, bear arms. And what I think, frankly, the last thing that we want is a military that has more power than the civilian leadership, because the military is not answerable to anybody except the executive branch, according to the Constitution. And if they are able to stand up and speak out against the politicians, then they're no longer answerable to that civilian leadership. So when you have a military in a democracy that stands up and says, no, we're not going to do this anymore, what you have is a military coup.
I don't think I'm asking for that, but I do think I'm asking for a military that is willing to ask serious questions and make reasoned, logical arguments to power. And one
well, the way that you do it, and the way that, as far as I can tell, dozens of flag officers have done in the last 4 or 5 years, is you resign your commission, you resign from the military, and then you speak out once you're a private citizen, which is what General Sanchez did.
And that seems to be the only thing you can do.
That's pretty much it. I mean, it's kind of like Al Gore's saying, you know, after the Supreme Court ruled against him, the only other option was armed revolution. And it was true. I mean, the Constitution doesn't provide any other option beyond the Supreme Court. The Constitution does not provide to the military the ability to speak back to the... I mean, the most they could do would be to say international law prevents me from doing this, which is what Lieutenant Wittada did. And there we have to honor Lieutenant Wittada. But look at what happened. I mean, they tried to put him into prison.
Yes.
So, I mean, that and frankly, appropriately so. Not that he should be put in prison for saying what he said or for doing what he did. But we do want to have a military that is answerable to the civilian leadership, not General Pervez Musharraf, who says, okay, that's it. I don't like the way the country's being run. I'm going to take it over.
You took the words out of my mouth. Yes, we don't.
Which is what happened in Pakistan.
Yes.
Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Here's how strange it's getting. The movie Rendition is coming out, I believe, next week. BBC did a big thing on it, although I haven't seen much coverage of it in the American press. But it's basically about a guy who is flying into the United States, a U.S. citizen. It's sort of the Jose Padilla story. He's flying into the United States. He gets snatched. He gets rendered to another country where he gets tortured. And his wife is going on this search to try and find him and bring him back. Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room, normally she's a citizen of the United Kingdom and lives outside of London and is normally in there running the chat room. She came to the United States last week for a visit for a few days And she hasn't dropped in to say hi, and I haven't gotten an email from her, and we're speculating in the chat room. Maybe she got rendered. I don't know. So, Sue, if you're out there and you're listening, phone home. We'd like to know you're okay. Isn't it weird that we live in a world where such a thing could even be possible? Clyde Prestowitz is with us. He's the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, and in my opinion, one of the most brilliant authors of our time. He's written a number of books that have certainly affected and changed my view of how things are going back decades. Clyde, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And econstrat.org, your website?
That's the website, exactly.
Okay. Econstrat.
Right.
You have been writing recently. I mean, I remember your book, One World Ready or Not, as I recall, was the title?
Well, Trading Places and...
Or Trading Places, I'm sorry.
Billion New Capitalists.
Yeah, Trading Places, 3 Billion New Capitalists, yeah. And Trading Places, actually, was the one that was opened with just an extraordinary... in any case, you're writing now about Canada and this economic suicide, this slow economic suicide that the U.S. is committing, suggesting that Canada might even surpass the United States. Give me your take on this.
Well, the funny thing is, this started off as a joke. I was at a dinner party, and someone asked the question, what country is going to be the next superpower? And, there were a number of answers. Some people said China. Some people said India. And, the questioner said, no, it's not it. So what is it? Canada. And everybody laughed. But then he went on to explain that, look, in the world to come, Florida's going to be underwater. The Gulf of Mexico is going to be uninhabitable because of hurricanes and heat. The southwest of the U.S. is going to run out of water. The Midwest will become a dust bowl. Canada has all the water. It's got all the oil. Shipping is going to go across the Arctic, so Canada will control the world's shipping. People will move north. Canada will become the breadbasket, the grain producer, rather than the U.S. Midwest. And so, therefore, Canada. And, at first it seemed, kind of funny, but when you think about it, it begins to make a lot more sense.
Are your comments what caused the loonie to go up so much? The Canadian dollar?
I don't think so. But that, however, is indicative of where things are going, because the loonie, as you say, has been on a...
Which is how Canadians affectionately refer to their dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
Our listeners who've never been to Canada know. Yeah.
It has been soaring, and it's soaring in response to the fact that the U.S. is running these enormous trade deficits. The U.S. is flooding the world with dollars, and there's a move in international financial markets away from the dollar. And the Canadian dollar, the loonie, has been the beneficiary of that.
Yeah, and Canada is not committing the economic suicide that the United States is. Speak to me for a moment or to our, to all of us here about the kind of economic suicide that the United States is committing, particularly with regard to trade. I mean, I think the wild spending and
right.
War and stuff are fairly obvious. And what can be done about it?
Well, two things. One is that the heart of the matter is that the U.S. is just being irresponsible. That is to say that we are consuming more than we produce. We're spending more than we earn. We're now borrowing from the rest of the world about 7% of GDP just to finance our current, lifestyle.
It's about $2 billion a day.
About a little over $2 billion a day now, most of that coming from three places, China, Japan, and the Middle East.
Mostly Saudi Arabia.
And what allows us to do that is two things. One is that we have a trade policy in which we take the position that unilateral free trade is good, and we would prefer to have bilateral free trade, but if the other guy doesn't open his market, we still take the position that our market should be open. Moreover, we also base our trade on the view that was well expressed by some leading economists a few years back, potato chips, computer chips, what's the difference? They're all chips. In other words, it doesn't make too much difference what we make because we're going to have a comparative advantage in something, and so it doesn't matter whether that happens to be potato chips or computer chips. So as a result of this, we acquiesce in a kind of a one world, two system kind of global trade system. That is to say, we have a global economy, but in that economy, you've got large players, China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, many of the Asian players playing essentially a neo-mercantilist game. Their economies are export-led. They're
all protecting their economies. I mean, if you want to export a car from the U.S. to China, there's a 20% tariff on it. If you want to export a car from China to the United States, it's a 2% tariff.
Yeah, but it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, but the bottom line is they are all pursuing export-led growth, which means that they manage their currencies to be undervalued, and they aim, as a matter of policy, to achieve trade surpluses. We, on the other hand, are pursuing this Adam Smith kind of laissez-faire, free trade kind of economy. And so the result is that they run up big surpluses and we run up big deficits. Now, the thing that allows that to happen is the role of the dollar. The dollar being the world's money, the world's currency, it means that we can buy things and we can borrow in our own currency. That makes us unique. So, for example, if you're Japanese and you want to buy oil, oil's priced in dollars. So if you're Japanese, you've got to make a Lexus, sell it, get dollars, and then go buy oil. But if you're American, you want to buy oil, you just call up the government printing office and you say, print some dollars. And you take the dollars, you get the oil. And so as long as the rest of the world will kind of accept these dollars, you know, we can buy anything we want and we don't have to make anything, we don't have to sell anything. We just kind of run the printing presses. The problem is that, so this basically allows us to be irresponsible, but it also allows our trading partners to be irresponsible because it means that they can kind of play with the dollar. They can intervene in international currency markets to drive the dollar up. They can buy dollars, drive it up, keep their own currencies low, and thereby facilitate their exports to us. So essentially, you've got a world in which all the players are being kind of irresponsible. And if everybody could and would promise to keep doing the same thing, it might be okay. But the problem is that nobody can.
But even if China, let's say that China and the United States both tomorrow morning went on the gold standard. I mean, you know, absolutely standardized their currency against some external and objective. You're still not going to have American manufacturers saying, gee, shall I pay $18 an hour to somebody to manufacture something here or pay $2 an hour to somebody in China?
No, I disagree with that. Because there are many industries in which paying $18 an hour in the U.S. Is still going to give you a lower overall cost than paying $2 in China because
of transportation,
because of productivity, because of transportation, mainly because of productivity. American workers are more productive than Chinese workers. And many industries, labor is not a big cost. We take the semiconductor industry. Labor is not a big part of the cost of making a semiconductor.
Then why are our semiconductors going overseas? Oh, because of the monetary thing.
Well, two reasons they're going overseas. One is because of the undervaluation of the currencies, and the other is because many of these countries, China one of them, but Singapore, Israel, many of these countries are offering tax holidays. They're offering capital grants. So let's say your plant's going to cost $8 billion, and the local government says, well, don't worry, we'll give you $4 billion. That makes that dramatically, the cost of labor is not a consideration. It's the cost of capital.
Right, it's hard for Alabama to compete with that.
It's the cost of capital. And that's huge. And the problem here is that the United States has no policy to respond to that.
Yeah, and we need to develop one. And you guys are working on it. Clyde Prestowitz, the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, econstrat.org, the website. Clyde Prestowitz, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Great,
bye-bye.
great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Leslie Tolf of the AFL-CIO up next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
21 minutes past the hour. Leslie Tolf is here. Am I pronouncing that right, Leslie? Leslie?
I'm here.
Hi.
Hi.
Your last name is pronounced Tolf?
Yes.
T-O-L-F. And you are the president of Union Privilege, the organization that provides consumer benefit programs to over 13 million members of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. And I'm looking at UnionPrivilege.org. Is that your website as well?
That is.
Okay. First of all, a question. I was very dismayed when I discovered that the AARP was really just basically, you know, making money on health insurance. That it wasn't really a membership organization, that they were just hustling health insurance. And in fact, they were one of the major advocates for the donut hole in the Medicare program so that they could sell insurance to cover it. And I felt totally screwed by that and we'll never join the AARP or have anything to do with them. And in fact, the health insurance company that they hooked up with, United Healthcare, paid their CEO $1.78 billion, and a large chunk of that money came from our tax dollars. Reassure me that what you guys are doing, William McGuire was his name, $1.78 billion. Reassure me that what you folks are doing is not something similar.
No, as a matter of fact, we are a membership organization like AARP. We are not in bed with the mortgage companies. I will, in the name of full disclosure, tell you that we have our own mortgage program through Chase, but we do not receive royalties on it. In fact, we can't receive royalties on it under the auspices of RESPA, government regulation. So the Save My Home hotline that we are initiating today is really separate and apart from that program, and really focuses on anybody who has an adjustable rate mortgage or finds himself in mortgage trouble.
This is great. And so this is a program that you guys have put together. You're obviously you have to do it with a bank. I mean, some bank, you're doing it with Chase.
No, we're not doing it with a bank, actually. We're doing it with a nonprofit counseling agency called MMI. It's Money Management International. They are the largest nonprofit counseling agency, and we went through due diligence with them to make sure that they weren't one of those, counselors on the corner,
who are just trying to get you to mortgage their house and give them all the money.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're very, very confident in the group, they have 100 offices nationwide, and of course they have this 800 number, and they provide free confidential advice.
That's great. The Save My Home hotline is 1-866-490-5361, but most people can't write that fast, so it's best just to go to unionprivilege.org or aflcio.org for a link to unionprivilege.
Exactly.
And because since most people can't spell privilege either.
It's one of those words. Privilege. No D.
Right. I still can't spell privilege. And, it's one of half a dozen words that I have never in my life learned how to correctly spell.
Maybe after this phone call.
I always want to put a D in it because
I know.
Back in the 17th, 18th centuries, there actually was a D in it. And so, in any case, we're talking with Leslie Tolf, the president of Union Privilege. This is a service which is available to union members only, or to
exactly.
Everybody?
Yep, union members only, and we believe that the unions are in the forefront of helping union members avoid the tsunami of foreclosures sweeping the country. We were in Ohio today for a press conference where there's a 130% increase in foreclosures since September of last year. And what we were amazed at with this survey, the poll that we did, was that these adjustable rate mortgage holders, first of all, one out of four holders missed a payment last year. Ouch. And of those that missed a payment, more than half of them don't know where to turn for help. So this hotline that's really going to provide this free assistance and a homekeeper action plan that they can then take armed with something, some document, to their mortgage lender or, heaven forbid, a mortgage broker, which don't get me on that, will really, really help them renegotiate while they're, heading down this steep curve.
Yeah. And for those people who are not members of unions, what do they do?
Well, Tom,
it's not that easy to join a union, you know, right off. Is this something, I know AFL-CIO has an organization for people who are not union members but who want to participate with the AFL-CIO. I forget the name of it.
Yeah, it's called Working America, and it's a fabulous organization.
Is this available to members of Working America?
Actually, it's not, but I tell you what is. Another component that we're doing that is available to everyone is a grant program, and it's for, unfortunately, it's only 7 states, and you're going to ask me which 7 states, and I'm going to quickly try to figure out which seven states those are. But in 7 states, they're eligible for a grant under $1 million endowment from HSBC. So there is information on that available through our website, through the hotline, to union members and non-union members alike.
That's great. So, in particular, if you're a union member, and if you're not, become one quickly!
Exactly!
Get over to unionprivilege.org or AFLCIO.org. Thank you so much, Leslie Tolf. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your call's up next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I'm so sick of all them TV shows. I need some dirt road onto my feet. Come on, let's point out shows where the red fern grows. Take a little walk in the country with me. Come on now.
Julia Roberts, this is from the Huffington Post. Julia Roberts was honored Friday night at an award, and George Clooney couldn't make it, so he sends a video tribute, and he's sitting in the video. He's sitting in a bathroom stall talking about how much he likes, you know, what a great actor Brad Pitt is, who co-starred with him in this movie. And all of a sudden, a foot starts coming over and tapping up against him, and so he jumps up and opens the door, and who's in the next stall but Brad Pitt, who says, "I have a wide stance." Yeah. Well, you think that's weird. It's getting even weirder out there. I mean, that was an intentional joke. This is the guy running for office. Jose Pepe Carrigal, running for office in Hialeah, Florida. He's running ads on the local Spanish stations. Se te gusta el sexo oral, vote por Carrigal por Concejal. I know I'm mangling the Spanish there, but what it translates into in English is, if you like oral sex, vote Carrigal for council. Yeah. He's 76 years old. He's served on the council since easily defeating 3 other candidates, according to the Miami Herald. He told the Miami Herald, "People want to give it a negative interpretation, but anyone who knows me and my way of being knows that I didn't mean it to commit or degrade or offend anyone." So, yeah, that's a platform. That's a real platform. Catherine in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Catherine, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to tell you about a resolution that's going to be at City Hall, in L.A. City Hall, City Council. Yeah, there's a resolution to withdraw the troops from Iraq, and we need a lot of people at L.A. City Hall tomorrow morning, 9:15, first in Maine. It's actually first in Tom Bradley now because he was our mayor for 20 years. But this is going to be the biggest city in the country to pass a resolution like this. Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston have already passed a resolution calling for all the troops to be withdrawn. Yes, it's only, you know, gesture,
yes, it's only a resolution, but that's how slavery got ended. That's how women got the vote. That's how that's how civil rights happened.
So
it all started with people speaking up and speaking out.
Yeah,
that's great,
LA
Catherine.
LA is sponsoring this, and we've already gone through city council several times, and the city council president, Eric Garcetti, passed this through committee. It got stuck in committee for a while. It's coming to the full council tomorrow morning at 9:15, LA City Hall. If anyone can make it down there, we need more people to impress them that this is
great.
The time to pass it now.
Great. Thank you, Catherine.
It's going to pass, and there'll be a big party for it when it does pass. And then we're going to try and get New York to come on board as well.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Thanks a lot for the heads up, and our many listeners in LA now know tomorrow morning 9:15 to show up at LA City Hall. Do it. Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
The discussion seems to have diverged since I've been on the line, but I wanted to talk to you about
martial law and you know, silent coup and that kind of stuff.
Sure, that's fine.
Have you seen the video that's popped up on YouTube by Ralph Nader that's called Things Are a Lot Worse Than We Thought?
I have not, but now that you've told me about it, I'll go looking for it this
afternoon.
Well,
it's there. You should be able to find it very easily. Just Google things that are a lot worse than we thought.
Yeah, I mean, we had Ralph Nader on the program here about, what, 3 months ago or so, and he was essentially saying that. Is there some revelation in there that I'm unaware of?
Well, I don't know if you're aware of it or not. You may very well be, but I'm going to repeat it anyhow. He refers to a meeting that was held sometime in the early part of the summer, I believe, in Springfield, Mass. Congressman John Oliver met with a number of representatives from the local towns. I think they were almost all, if not all, lawyers. And they're talking about impeachment. All these towns had voted for impeachment. Mm-hmm. And he was totally unresponsive. But then he added, voluntarily, and this is as pretty much as a quote as I can give you, the current autocratic executive, the White House, would attack Iran from the air, declare a national emergency, institute martial law, and call off the 2008 election. Now, Oliver said this.
It was a member of Congress who said this.
That's correct. He is the representative.
And he said this, and did, now let me get the context right. Did he say this by way of saying, therefore, if we try to impeach him, he'll do this, and that's why we're not trying to impeach him?
I don't believe that's what he said. He said he wasn't going to support impeachment.
Oh,
and then
he
apparently added this voluntarily.
He just thinks it could happen with or without impeachment.
I would say that's incredible.
Now let's keep in mind, Tom, just because a member of Congress says something doesn't mean that it's true, because there's a lot of wacky members of Congress. Yeah. That said, though, I agree with you. Things are worse than they seem in many regards. And frankly, things are a lot better than they seem in many regards, too, because so many people now are active, are aware, are getting out there, are speaking out. You've got the media is changing. The zeitgeist in this country, the ghost of the people, the spirit of the people is changing. And I am convinced that if the Bush administration tried to declare martial law and call off the elections, that it would bring this country, that we would not allow it to stand. I don't know if it would be the military, or if it would be Congress, or it would be the people in the streets, and it might be all three, but I just don't believe in this day and age that the Bush administration can get away with it. Just don't believe it. Tim in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air.
I'm sorry, there's a little crackle there. I couldn't hear you clearly. Let's see. Still much of the discussion on globalization and trickle-down economics is driven by ideology and fantasy. But I'm just calling to give you a heads-up on a new way of looking at economics that's evolved over the last 20 years, and that's from the science of complexity. And so I have a book recommendation. The book is called Origin of Wealth, Evolution, Complexity, and the Radical Remaking of Economics, written by a fellow named Eric Beinhocker, Beinhocker. Anyway, this is terrific stuff, and I think when it comes to the core of the discussion, they're really great.
Can you give me a one-sentence summary of it, Tim?
The idea.
Or maybe two?
Yeah, the central idea, and this is a real revolution in economics, is that the mathematics of connected nodes and the links among those nodes, like economic nodes, allows you to make statements and predict behaviors, economic behaviors, and that it has a huge implication for globalization. And as a matter of fact, people have gotten rich off of this.
Sure. Well, the problem, though, is this is also, in a way, it's kind of sounds like it might be building on Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, the theory that economics and economic activity, particularly global economic activity, is so complex that it's impossible for a government to participate in it or try to affect it by regulation or rules, because those rules will always be, you know, behind the fact. In fact, literally from second to second, conditions change so rapidly that you can't regulate things. And it sounds nice in theory, but the reality is that the complexity, in a large part, is taking place within a framework that's established by government policies, by, you know, I mean, all the rules of the marketplace are established by governments.
Well, this is actually coming from quite a different direction. This is coming out of the Santa Fe Institute, and the fellow used to run the complexity lab there.
Interesting. And give me the title again. I'll check it out. Okay, what's the title?
Okay, the title is Origin of Wealth, Evolution.
Origin of Wealth.
By a fellow named Eric Beinhocker.
Great. Tim, thank you very much. It sounds interesting. I'll check it out. Len in New York City. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I've been buying Canadian dollars for the last year or so, or year and a half. And, you know, it's a heads up that, speaking of good books, Jim Rogers, an international investor for many years, wrote a book called Hot Commodities, talking about the cycle of commodities.
Right.
And a guy named Peter Schiff wrote a book called Crash Proof. But basically, we're in a spiral right now. I walk around the corner from my home, and I see a line of SUVs as though, you know, there were a presidential motorcade, just people parked on the street. And we're in a spiral now where we're buying oil, paying for it with dollars that whoever is selling us oil is constantly dumping on the market, making the dollar cheaper, then makes oil more expensive. It's up to a new high today, over $86 a barrel.
Yeah, and gold just hit $757. What we're seeing is not the increase in the cost or value of commodities. What we're seeing is the steady erosion in the value of the dollar.
Well, it's combined, and it's, you know, other countries that tax oil and that, which make it a little more dear for people so they don't piss it away, pardon my French, and recycle the tax dollars into benefits for the people in the country, are managing, whereas we are really just cutting our, limbs off by pandering to the average person who just thinks that this is, this can keep going on. And 2 years from now, when oil is $125 a barrel, the Canadian dollar is going to be well over $1.25.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, and I'd say that's probably true of most of the other solid foreign currencies. Louise and I have a little bit of money for retirement, and 2 or 3 years ago we moved much of it into Canadian investments. And we've seen them go up dramatically, not so much because the investments have gone up, but because the dollar's gone down relative to the Canadian dollar. And I think a lot of people are starting to look at investing outside the United States, which is a tragic thing, because it ultimately is not a good thing for America. I mean, so you have to make these choices. It's like, do we do what's best for the country or what's best for our family? 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
All right. Hi, Tom there. All right. I just wanted to let your listeners know that, stuff. You were talking about Don Over earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. Is you're listening there on WHMT in Warwick, Massachusetts. Is he your congressman?
Yes, he is.
Oh, interesting.
All right, and in Franklin County and Greenfield, Mass, I'm sure you know where that is, don't you?
Yeah, I've been there.
Oh, yeah. All right, I figured, I used to live in Vermont here. All right, we last May at town meetings all across this county, which is his section of the his constituency, we passed by town meeting, to ask him to support an investigation of the administration. And refuses to do so.
Yeah. Well, that's something that you all should be holding him accountable for. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that when our members of Congress don't do what we want, we have to say to them, sorry, buddy, we did not elect you to lead us. In the United States, we do not elect leaders. I mean, if you got a great idea and you want to get out there with it, John Kennedy thinking we should put a man on the moon, well, in many cases, we'll all get behind it. But if we don't all get behind it, if George Bush says we're going to go off to war in Iraq and most of us say, no, you're not, then he shouldn't, because we elect representatives in the United States, not leaders. That's why it's called the House of Representatives, for example. Jack in Denver, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Jack.
Hey.
What's up?
Are you there?
Yeah, I am, and you're on the air.
Okay, thanks for having me. You know, I just, with all this discussion that you've been having about martial law potential and silent coups, in the discussion lately, it seems to me that the issue of September 11th is a catalyzing event for fear and promulgating, you know, the possibility of public opinion supporting some of the erosion of the Constitution that we've seen. I feel like the discourse has gotten to the point where if you even bring up questioning the official story, you're labeled, you know, conspiracy theorist or something like that. And I think there's a more centrist viewpoint that's available out there, and that there's serious cause for questioning some of the things that happened.
You're talking about around 9/11.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you, and I think that we need to have a serious investigation, a real, genuine, serious investigation of this. I mean, it took us 40 years to figure out who killed John Kennedy. How long is it going to take to figure out what happened on 9/11? Hopefully not 40 years. Tom, thank you for the call. Tom in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Tom.
Hey, thank you. I'm bringing this up, and it's a very unpopular opinion, and that is that there's an old adage, divide and conquer. I think we've been led down the garden path by having all these artificial polarities, these contrived polarities of Democrat and Republican and black and white. And the truth is that if we look at who's putting the money behind each party, it's really the same people. And the real constituency of our elected leaders is not us, the people that used to vote before there were voting boxes. But it's not us, it's the people who puts them into power. And I think we're seeing right now, it's pretty clear, it doesn't really matter who's in. One thing that I've done is I've gone back and quietly just looked at the executive orders for the last 30 years. And it looks like it's been the same footprint, going in the same direction. So when we're looking at...
Yeah, it's just that they're getting larger and larger and larger. Tom, to a certain extent, I don't disagree with you, and Ralph Nader, for that matter, that much of the Democratic Party has become like all of the Republican Party, or at least some of the Democratic Party, probably much of it. I don't disagree with that. And that's why, rather than, you know, just saying, ah, screw it, let's walk away from it, that's why I've been saying all along... A, I don't support the Democratic Party. I support us, people like you and me, showing up at your local monthly meeting of your local county Democratic Party or your local precinct and taking it over. And when enough of us do that, the Democratic Party will no longer be Republican light.
I hear you. And I'm just trying to identify with them, because I know who, but the real them is not, you know, it's not who we think it is. You know, the
I think the real them is the real them is corporate power and inherited wealth in the United States and around the world, frankly. And
exactly.
there's another them there's two other thems that are aligned with them. One are people who have a hardcore, absolutely unyielding religious agenda, who believe that theocracy is how, you know, the nation should be ruled by them, speaking on behalf of God, and combined with what John Dean refers to as the authoritarian personality bunch, which I think is what Cheney is all about. I think that's why Bush and Cheney, both of them, I think that's why when Bush and Cheney first came into office, and now we're discovering in February, March, April of 2001, in the first 3 months that they were in office, they were already setting it up with all of the telecom companies except Verizon to spy on you and me. And when the CEO of Verizon said no to them, he found his butt in jail, which is where he is right now. And now he's starting to fight back. People are starting to speak out. General Sanchez starting to speak out. I mean, it's happening. It's happening. Steve in Eagle Creek, Oregon. Got a little less than a minute here, Steve, before we got to wrap up the show today.
Okay, two things really fast. One, you were right that $750 million bet, somebody lost some money. And the other thing is your previous...
What bet is that? What are you talking about?
We spoke, the last time we spoke, I mentioned that $750 million put between September 1st and September 20th.
Right.
You stated that it was not going, that nothing was going to happen. You were right.
Yeah.
The
tragically.
Two things. The guys that your previous caller that mentioned the possibility of something bad happening if they took action, that's a very high probability. The other thing is maybe that peak oil is on the horizon and they want to keep it relatively quiet.
Yeah, and it's not, you're right, yeah, Steve, and it's not a maybe that peak oil's on the horizon, it's here. I'm just wondering if the plan is to hold off the economic disaster until after a Democrat gets into the White House. Well, obviously that's the plan. I'm just wondering if they can do it. I don't think they can, but, you know, time will tell. We'll talk about that more as time comes along. Tomorrow, Alex Epstein is back. David Harvey here with a brief history of neoliberalism. Your calls, the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.